Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Once again, today our guest is Dr. Christopher Thornburg. Dr. Thornburg is a founding principal of Beacon Economics and one of California's leading economic forecasters. He's one of the economists that accurately predicted the California crash and the recession that followed. Dr. Thornburg, welcome back.
Good to be here.
We were just starting to talk about the proposal to let people have a bankruptcy judge, I think, decide what they should owe on their home. And I guess we can pick it up from there and also maybe discuss why that why the banks are really not foreclosing on some of these homes, as the losses might be so great that they may not be viable institutions if, in fact, they took those losses.
Right, absolutely, on both counts. Well, first of all, talk a little bit about that bankruptcy thing. Again, that was a big push for a while in D.C. It kind of came to an end, in part because, of course, the right side of the bench was vociferously against it. But what's funny, of course, is I think you would find that most American homeowners, whether they were in trouble or not on their home, were probably not for it. Remember, a lot of folks who are in trouble today are in trouble not because they bought a home at the peak. In fact, I saw a study that had come out of Fullerton not too long ago where they showed that many people, somewhere between a third and 40% of folks losing their house today are not people who bought at the peak, but rather refinanced at the peak.
Sure.
Tons of money out of their home.
Sure.
And they went out and they bought toys.
Mm-hmm.
They went out and bought cars and TVs and boats. You walk into court, bankruptcy court, and you show the judge this, and he'll say, well, okay, you can keep your house, but you're going to lose everything else. And, you know, frankly, you know, your irresponsible behavior may be such that maybe you can't even keep your house. You had a lot of people who lied on their mortgage applications, whether or not that was approved by the mortgage broker at the time. Again, those folks walk in, they're going to have to admit in front of a judge that they committed fraud. Realistically, a lot of people should be glad that we still have non-recourse loans, because while they can take your house, they can't take everything else.
That's very true.
And, you know, I think that there's an advantage not just for the bank there, but also for the individual.
You brought up in our first segment this concept of inflation. So, you know, there's some very smart people on both sides of that argument where that we're going to have deflation or we're going to have inflation. So I'd kind of like to understand the concept. When do you have the pieces in place for deflation? Because let's say Japan has certainly had those pieces.
Yeah. Bruce, I'm sorry, but I have yet to hear any smart economists say we have the potential for deflation.
Okay.
It's simply unrealistic. Look, the deflation in Japan is a function of the fact that they have very tight monetary policy. It's not because of some economic situation. That simply is not the case. It simply is not true.
What do you mean by tight monetary policy? I need to understand that.
Right. So right now, of course, if you want to think about the potential for inflation, it's largely driven by the money supply.
Okay.
And what the government does is pursues a tight money policy, which basically means they don't expand the money supply very much. And Japan's central bank is infamous for tight money policies. Japan had problems with inflation, big problems in inflation in the 50s. It sort of scarred their national psyche, at least among economists. And they continue to be a nation that worries so much about the potential for inflation that they have allowed deflation to kick into the system. If Japan wanted to get rid of deflation, it's a pretty simple process. The only thing they need to do is turn on the old printing press, and away you go. We've seen that process work in Zimbabwe, Argentina, Brazil. There's no mystery on how you fight deflation from a policy standpoint.
Now, okay, explain the difference between what you're saying there and national debt, because, I mean, they have huge national debt, correct?
That is true. They have huge national debt. But again, one of the reasons you want to avoid inflation under those sort of circumstances is the cost of that debt for Japan is really low. People are remarkably comfortable investing in Japanese government bonds because they have such a great history of low inflation that it makes it a very, very safe place to park your money.
Okay.
So, in a sense, if they started inflating, it would make the cost of them borrowing significantly higher, and that's something, of course, they want to avoid.
Okay. Now, in the United States, if we started inflating, and that coincides with something like a $20 trillion federal deficit, that would not be a pretty picture.
That would not be a pretty picture at all. Now, the only good news there is our existing debt would actually become much cheaper.
Yes.
Because those interest rates are fixed. So from that perspective, there is less of a worry in the short run. In fact, in many ways, a lot of folks have made the very real point that a little inflation goes a long way in this kind of economy. We've already talked about all the homeowners who are underwater. We've already discussed, for example, a lot of the other types of loans that are underwater. For example, loans on commercial real estate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are a nagging problem in the economy, and this goes back to something you asked about before, which is this mark-to-market rule. I think it's worth sort of taking that up and then circling back around to the point we're about to make here.
Okay.
You had a change in the beginning of 2009 in how banks deal with distressed debt. They went from mark-to-market to mark-to-myth, as the joke goes,
mm-hmm.
Where they don't need to really be aggressive in how they value loans, even though the loan is probably largely underwater. In fact, in many ways, as long as the bank can keep the loan more or less current, they don't have to acknowledge the potential loss on that loan due to the fact that property prices have fallen so much. If you forced mark-to-market on banks today, you would probably completely collapse the banking system. You would probably see 6,000, maybe 7,000 banks wiped out, because as soon as you did that, that would basically they would all be out of compliance with their Tier 1 capital needs.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that would not be a terribly good thing to do right now. The U.S. economy doesn't need 6,000 banks going under. We have neither the manpower to deal with it, not to mention the money that would be necessary to bail out all the depositors in those institutions. It would be a fiscal disaster across the board. So with that in mind, they changed the rules, and as such, a lot of banks who are really technically insolvent are being able to operate because of their ability to pretend that loans that are not fine are fine. And this is another reason why you're seeing this big backlog of foreclosures, because, again, banks don't have a lot of incentive to be real aggressive in foreclosing, because it just is going to hurt their Tier 1 capital ratio. Much better to pretend things are okay.
Now, just interjecting one thing,
sure.
Isn't that kind of what Japan did in the beginning?
Absolutely, but they didn't do so in the same way that we're doing it.
Okay.
It is similar in some ways. And here's the gig. There, it created a sort of land of zombie banks, and it became difficult for really anybody to raise any kind of debt in that kind of market, which hurt the downturn that much worse.
Okay.
Banks are a little different, and they're responding a little different than that.
Okay.
Which is an important thing to keep in mind. For example, one of the nice things about the United States economy relative to, say, Japan, is we still have a fairly competitive market. I have some friends of mine, for example, who used to work for Western Financial Bank. They were rolled into Wachovia when Wachovia got bought, and then when Wachovia got rolled in the Wells, they said, we're tired of this mess. We're tired of having a different master every week. And they left, and they started their own bank.
Mm-hmm.
And you see people starting new banks in the midst of this mess, and they are becoming the sort of new entrepreneurs. They will be the guys who will pick up the slack for those banks that simply won't lend because of the fact that they're just such a total mess. So, you know, that is going to be inevitably our savior, if you will.
Okay.
Now, where I was going with this whole thing is that when you consider the situation that the banks are in right now. And you think, well, what would be a good way to get these banks out of the pit they're in? Well, you know, inflation, a little inflation goes a long way. You could easily inflate the economy, which picks up the asset values, which makes these loans whole again. And boy, would that take a tremendous amount of pressure off our banking system.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes back to the, and that again goes as another comparison between us and Japan. Japan not only did not pursue loose money policies, but they certainly didn't go anywhere near creating the potential for inflation, which meant that their banks were underwater for a very long time. This time around, you could make the argument. The Federal Reserve has stood up and said quite clearly that, you know, we do not believe inflation. We will fight inflation. We are anti-inflation, as our job is. But when you really think about it, you think about where Bernanke is right now, a little inflation would be a heck of a relief for our financial system.
Now, when you get inflation, it usually happens to wages too, correct?
Eventually, yes.
Okay. I mean, do you see that being a possibility in this environment? Because I don't know that unemployment's going to be very much better.
Not very much in the short run. You're absolutely right on that.
Okay.
But nonetheless, it is not really what they're thinking about. So, in fact, that would be one of the arguments why a little inflation would be good right now, because it would, again, allow banks to get from underwater. But what are the consequences of that? You know, Bruce, you've been around long enough. What kind of mortgage rates were you looking at back in 1982?
I refied my house to be an investor at 17.5.
There you go. So, you know, that's the long-run consequence of that kind of activity. It helps in the short run, but wow, does it hurt in the long run.
Do you view that we're going to have, let's maybe go out further than just a couple of years, in the next decade, do you think the United States will have positive GDP growth that's over 1%?
Of course.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, no. Look, in the short run, the U.S. economy has got a lot of problems that we still have to deal with. I mean, there's no doubt about that.
Okay.
And we're not going to get out of this all that easy. I think everybody needs to take a nice, what's the word I'm like? Everybody needs a gut check.
Okay.
To understand that the rebound you're seeing today is not sustainable. But be that as it may, if the government does the right thing, which is to say to back off on the stimulus, to allow this economy to regrow in the way it needs to really be sustainable in the long run, which is to say less consumer spending, more exports, less credit. Once we pull through this mess, the fundamentals for long-run growth are still there. Come on, this is a great place.
No, I agree.
Great technology, great workers. Everything's going right for the United States. We just have to sort of work through the excesses of the last 15 years.
And what's the time frame that's likely to occur as far as some of those excesses? And I guess the reason I was thinking, and I look back on the GDP growth that we had, let's say in the last 10 years,
yeah.
Most of it came from, I guess, a residual stock bubble and then the real estate. I don't know that you're going to have that going forward.
Yeah, actually, that's not true.
Okay.
I would argue that well, first of all, let's not confuse it, sort of supply and demand.
Okay.
When we talk about GDP, we're talking about the fundamental ability for an economy to produce goods. And that has been expanding at a normal pace through the course of the last 10 years. Our ability to produce goods and services goes up about 3% in real terms per year. And it's been doing that for decades, right?
Okay.
Now, the question is, what are we using that additional productive output for? And my long-run position is that we've been using it for the wrong thing, namely to supply too much consumer spending, to bring in too many imports, and not enough towards more exports and more business spending. Now, that's a function with problems on the demand side of the equation. Don't confuse that with the ability to supply goods, which is just fundamental to the nature of the U.S. economy. That's why we're going through this tough time. It's because demand is shifting, less consumer spending, more exports. And that it takes a while for the supply mechanisms to rejigger themselves to match that new demand. And that's why we go through these sort of painful slumps in the back end of these kind of downturns when there is a fundamental shift happening in the underlying core of U.S. demand.
Okay.
But it's incorrect to say that demand creates supply.
Okay.
Rather, the supply is the question is how is supply being altered on the basis of demand? Because the supply is fundamental.
It seems from, and this is why I really enjoy interviewing you, because I don't understand a lot of the things that you do. But it looked like the GDP growth was certainly supported by a lot of equity extraction.
And, oh, absolutely.
And so if you don't have that, and you also have somebody thinking, okay, I'm going to really have to save for my retirement, I just wonder what kind of bite that takes out of what is 70% of our GDP engine, the ability to buy stuff.
Well, that's exactly my point, right? If we hadn't had that big equity bubble, and we hadn't had Americans go out and try to spend too much, then you would have seen that ability to supply get shifted towards other uses, namely exporting and business spending.
Okay.
So it was the problem on the demand side that created the misallocations on the supply side.
Okay. Let's go a little bit more local and talk about the California budget situation.
Yeah.
That's a pretty big number, but you pointed out...
No, it's not.
Well, that it was interesting. You know, you pointed out that California has a $1.9 trillion economy and a $20 billion deficit. So that is a small percentage. That's 1%.
Yes, our budget problems are political. They're not economic. If we had the leadership in Sacramento that was willing to make some basic decisions on how the state needs to finance what it needs to do, this could be a very painless transition. Look, we don't have a government that spends a lot of money. Government spending in the state as a percent of our economy is about average for American states. The problem is they spend it in wrong places. There's too many pet projects, not enough oversight, and a lot of that gets wasted. At the same time, we're not a high tax state. Instead, what we are is kind of a dumb tax state where we put high taxes on small bases, which makes us a very tax-unfriendly place for certain constituencies. But for a large majority of Californians, this is a great place to live because they don't pay much in the way of taxes at all. So it's a problem that if we had the political will, we could probably fix our budget problem and make ourselves a more tax-friendly state. The sad thing is we don't seem to have that political will.
Does that, I'm trying to read into that statement, does that mean Prop 13 is a...
Goner.
Okay.
Absolute goner. Prop 13 has got to be just one of the greatest miscarriages of fiscal injustice ever. I mean, it's just so phenomenal to me that that was even allowed to exist. You got to understand, back into politics of the day, that was challenged rightly under the Fairness Clause, which says that, you know, citizens should not be treated differently. You know, if you receive similar services, you ought to be paying similar dues. And it's pretty clear, when you have two houses next to each other with two individuals with roughly the same level of income, and yet one person is fortunate enough to have owned that for 25 years and the other person for 1 year, you know, these folks use the same basic social services.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason that one person should be paying six times as much as the other. That's a complete miscarriage of justice. And that is what Proposition 13 has given us.
Now, how do you get that changed? I mean, that's a vote of the people or no?
It should have been overturned in the California Supreme Court, to be perfectly honest with you. But for reasons that still elude me, instead it was more or less allowed to exist.
Okay.
Which is just amazing to me. So, yes, now what you have to do is you have to get a vote of the people and get rid of this miscarriage. As you've already noted, good luck.
I mean, that's a two-thirds majority, right?
I think so.
Yeah,
I think so. But it is there's no easy way of doing it. That's for sure.
Okay, yeah. Is California right now having migration negative? I know we have immigration coming in, but we also have exiting domestic migration. Are we overall negative at this point?
Well, you know, new numbers just came out, and I'm going to have to plead ignorance on that. I have not sat down and looked at them. But my understanding is, just from some of the reports I've heard, is that, yes, we're seeing negative net migration, largely due to the weak state of the labor markets.
Okay.
The good news is, on the back end of this thing, when we come out of this mess, we're going to be enjoying a lower, a weaker dollar, which is good for the state, and lower home prices, which is very, very good for the state. So I'm optimistic.
Okay.
That when we do pull out of this mess, California is really going to come out of it in a big way, and we're going to grow. The problem is, we're not there yet. We have some time yet before we get to that point.
Is there anything that's going to be terribly negative happen to us as in the United States, as we have become the world's largest debtor nation?
Well, the good news there is, again, that the dollar has to go down at some point in time. China, India, Russia, Brazil, many of these nations have made it an explicit policy to keep the U.S. dollar strong, and they do so by taxing their folks to buy U.S. treasuries. But that is a strategy that at some point in time is going to end, and when it does end, the dollar will necessarily fall. Now, what that means is they are going to buy a U.S. treasury, say a 10-year treasury, at, I don't know, say a 3% interest rate. And they'll get the 3%, but at the same time, they'll probably lose 15% of the value of that investment because of the decline of the dollar. So in the long run, that's a negative investment for those nations, for us, which is just, you know, when you think about it from a policy perspective, they are taxing Chinese peasants to really more or less subsidize American consumption, which is just, again, one of the most phenomenal miscarriages of justice ever, but that's how it's been working out.
Well, do you see that at some point somebody on the other side of that trade doesn't like that and they stop?
Well, you know, they can if they want to, but understand the implications of that immediately is a dollar that falls 10, 15, maybe even 20% against the value of their currency. You remember, we keep hearing that, wow, China really has us over the barrel, but that's not true. Bruce, you know as well as I do the old expression. You owe the bank $10,000, mm-hmm. The bank owns you.
Right.
You owe the bank $1 million, you own the bank.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly where we are with the Chinese right now. We own them, not the other way around.
We've got about 2.5 minutes. The world reserve currency status, what privileges does that give us?
Well, we get what we call seniorage, which is to say that we can print money. People want to hang on to that money. And as a result of that, again, we get a little subsidy kick out of that. Beyond that, there's not really much value to it. It's not that important of a status. It's not as if somehow other Netherlands or England or France are significantly negatively impacted because the euro or the pound is not the world currency. So it's not that big of a deal.
Okay. In just the last couple months, we've had Dubai, we've had Greece.
Yep.
How do these things affect what's going to go on for the United States?
Well, we left our worries of private bank debt behind. The new worry in the financial markets is sovereign debt.
Okay.
A lot of nations have ramped up their spending to levels that aren't sustainable, and a lot of folks are worried that you're going to see the same wave of losses occurring in the sovereign debt arena that we saw in the banking private arena, and that will cause similar lockups in the credit market and have the secondary effects we've seen through the last downturn. As a result of that, a lot of folks are yet again moving into the U.S. dollar, and you're seeing the dollar come up again, which is too bad because it's not going to help our recovery. But that is what the worry is.
Okay. Well, I have enjoyed our interviews again, Dr. Thornburg. Thank you very much for joining us, and it looks like you've got quite a speaking schedule these days.
It does keep me moving, that's for sure.
That's great. Well, I'm glad you have an input in our state, and hopefully someone will listen to you up there.
Sounds good.
All right, Dr. Thornburg, thanks for joining us.
Okay.
All right, bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.